one of our own on WNR.
The sound of Waterford.
In this eighth programme from the second series of One of Our Own, John O'Connor is interviewed by Catherine Foley about his life in the newspaper business and his love of singing. Roseanne Foley recorded and edited the series, which is produced by An Corsacock.
This was made with funding from Commissioner na Man and the television licence fee.
John O'Connor, a respected newspaper man, was deputy editor and news editor of the Munster Express over many years. And listeners will recognise his voice from the weekly slot he did reviewing the regional press on the national airwaves.
I was born in Parliament Street in Waterford, which is inside the old city walls, which many years later was a great attribute to me, because I grew up in Ferrybank. We moved to Ferrybank when I was very small, and I grew up in Ferrybank, and lots of the lads in the city would say, you're from across the river and everything like that, and I took great pleasure in telling them, no, I was born inside the city walls.
And you were proud of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ferrybank, when I was growing up, you had your colours, you were either Waterford or Kilkenny, and most of them were Kilkenny.
John went on to tell me about his parents and his O'Connor family name.
My father's name is Jack O'Connor, although I have loads of cousins in Passage East called Connors.
And where
we got the O, I don't know. There's a lot of documentation after my grandfather was lost at sea, and there's official documentation who he was, John as well, John O'Connor, John Connors, and John Connor, and everything like that. My father was from Cheek Point in County Waterford. He was a fisherman for most of his life, and in his later years he worked in the boat club in Waterford. My mother was from Limerick.
And what was your mother's
name? My mother, Maureen, and her maiden name was Winder. She came to Waterford as a girl when Denny's in Limerick closed down, and her father worked for Denny's, and I suppose he had the choice of either coming to Waterford to Denny's here or take redundancy or whatever it was at the time. But he had a brother working here as well, so they came down. My mother, Maureen, her mother was Catholic, but her father was Church of Ireland. And so I have Church of Ireland, a lot of Church of Ireland cousins as well. I remember they lived in Ferrybank as well. We all moved. And my grandfather used to take my grandmother down to Mass on a Sunday morning, and he'd go down to the Abbey. And obviously the Church of Ireland services weren't as long as the Catholic service, because he was waiting by the wall to pick her up again when she came from Mass. Actually, it's an interesting thing considering now, when his name is Fred. When Fred died, all the neighbours came along, and they all walked from down as far as at the house down to the Abbey, in the Abbey Church in Ferrybank, and they stopped at the gate, no further. In those days, imagine, now that was the early 60s, in those days it was a reserved sin to attend the Church of Ireland service or wedding or anything like that. You had to go to the bishop.
When John told me about his primary school education in Ferrybank, I beamed with pride, as my own great-grandfather, William Canis Foley, and his son Dan were both principals in this school. And Dan's son, my own father, Joe Foley, was a student there too.
When I was there, the principal was Richard Ling. There was Paddy Kiley and Frank Heelan. And as I said, it was a great school for me. It was full of air. Do you know what they used to do? They used to, they wouldn't close up the school, but they'd take classes, and it's all full of houses now. But they used to take us down the fields, and describe all the birds to us, the leaves, the trees, the bushes, and even, and he used to give us little sayings in Irish that I can remember. I also remember in those days, the New Ross, the Waterford to New Ross Railway was still going. And it's they're in the process of making it a greenway now, but it was still going. And I can still remember the teaching. If we'd heard the train, for him, the train, not for him. You pick up all these little phrases. Now, what I also remember, I didn't realise it at the time, in the early time, how I could never get near the fire. But of course, the teachers were being, without ever letting on, they were making sure that maybe the boys whose clothes might be a bit damp or something, they got the fire. It was a great school, and I'm very glad that I went there.
I know you made your communion because Annie, I've seen a photograph of you that Annie Brophy took.
Yeah, I went to school when I was four, went to Water Park, but we were living in town for a short period, and when I moved to Ferrybank, even though I went to the National School of Ferrybank, I made my communion with workers. I'd been prepared there, and that was in St. John's in Waterford. And of course, the after that then it was the Sacred Heart, or as the old people of Ferrybank called it, the Chapel of Ease. It was a bigger deal from the religious aspect as opposed to the social aspect that it is now.
I mean, as an only child, did you have cousins? Did you make much money for your communion? Do you remember
no,
that?
No, not at all.
Nothing.
Tuppence halfpenny. I'm unusual in so far as that I'm an only child. My father was an only child and my mother was an only child. So I've no uncles, brothers or sisters, no uncles or aunts, or no first cousins. So the old piggyback was fairly scarce, all right, yeah.
As a young boy, John won first place in a nationwide under-12 Gaeling singing competition. This early success was to have an impact on the rest of his life.
Well, that was a mad thing. That was like the X Factor of the day. It really was. And I sang the Angels Chorus from Maritana, translated into Irish.
Oh my God, do you have a line of it?
Angel Day, our food, Trastirn or something, I don't. It was translated by a man called Frank Elan. He was a national school teacher in Waterford, in Ferrybank. I also remember Brenda Boyer's sister, Olive, his oldest, she won the under 16 at the time. Yeah,
but brilliant.
And I've no recording of it.
After his Gaeling win, John was much in demand as a singer, and he soon began singing with the local Cayley band.
After I won the Gaeling thing, I got an offer from the Tramore Cayley band, would you believe? And so my mother used to come with me because I was too young to be going to dances. But I used to sing with the Tramore Cayley band at dances all over the place, you know. And the material then was all sort of Bridie Gallagher and Eileen Donaghy, and there was a guy called Charlie McGee, I think he, Dina Murphy. A lot of it was stuff that was played on Walton's. They were the songs that were very popular, and a lot of those songs, they were all the
ones. Would you sing a cappella, or would the Cayley band come?
Oh, with the band, the Cayley band, yeah.
Well, so I can just imagine you on the stage. Were you a precocious little boy?
No, I wasn't. And I was never what you call, even years after, I was never what you call a good mover.
After his second level schooling, John became a member of the workforce, but he continued to sing at weekends.
When you finished secondary school, where did you go then?
For a very, very brief period, I worked for George Chapman in Waterford. Would you believe it or not, I was blending and roasting their coffee in a premises, but it was never, you know, it was always going to be a temporary job. And really what I had in mind was most of my family on my father's side went to sea, and I was applying to Irish Shipping. I was going there. But in the meantime, while I was with Chapman's, and I got an offer to sing with the Maurice Mulcahy Orchestra. Now, they were a 12, 15-piece orchestra at the time, and I was 17, of course, yeah. And I was there for nearly a year, but it was a fabulous experience, music-wise, but it wasn't really suitable at all. I was playing with people who were old enough to be my father, and most were married men and older. And it just wasn't, I was treated very well and everything, but it just wasn't. And one of my neighbours worked at the Munster Express, and they were looking for an odd job person for. So I went into, while I was waiting for our shift, I went into the Munster Express, and I was doing things like going to the post, sweeping the floor, doing anything really. I was in the Munster Express, I'd say, about 6 months when the call came. And so I went up, and old J.J. Walsh, so I said to him that I was leaving. So he asked me where I was going. So he said, well, look, he said, if you want to stay, he said, I'll give you an apprenticeship. Now, I was more interested in the journalism side, I suppose, but so this put me in a dilemma, because I wanted to go to sea, but my music, where would I play if I was on a ship all the time? And so, funny enough, my mother thought I should have gone, which would be unusual, but my dad, whose own father had been lost at sea, said no. He said stay on shore. So I did, and that was the start of me in the Munster Express.
Although John enjoyed his work when he started out at the Munster Express as a printer, he soon got itchy feet.
First of all, when I was there, I was an apprentice printer. I actually printed the newspaper before I ever wrote for it, but then I handed in my notice in the Munster Express, and off I went to London.
In 1970, John married Marie Bowler while they were both living in London.
We got married in the Church of St. Thomas More in Lordship Lane in London.
Did you have many Waterford friends at the wedding in London?
A few came over from Waterford, we had, my mother came over, my dad wasn't well enough to come over. And I had a couple of cousins who were living in London. Again, I said I had no uncles and aunts, no brothers or sisters, no...
So you had a good wedding.
So there weren't too many. And we held a reception, it was in Over the King's Head pub in Peckham. So I always tell people that Rodney and Delby were downstairs.
It was at this stage in his career that John took a leap of faith, gave up his job in the printing industry, and became a full-time professional musician.
I was working in the Camberwell College of Art. I was at a level below lecturer. It was an annex of the London College of Printing. And all the Commonwealth countries, you send their apprentices there and into Camberwell to be trained. And so
As printers?
Well, yes, yeah. But you see, when I left the Munsters, I had already done, we went to the Crawford in Cork, and we did, we used to 3 months every year. So when I left, I had the junior, intermediate and senior trade certs, which would have qualified me to be a FOSS instructor. And there was plenty of opportunities. And I was working in the college, I was doing well, but I was playing music. I ended up just giving up the college and just doing music full time. Mm-hmm. So I was in the house band in the Hibernian Ballroom in Fulham. And that was a huge...
Now, were you lead singer with them?
Yeah, and guitar player. Yeah. The Detroit show band.
Your style was you'd sing.
I was lucky because I played guitar. So, in those days, the lead singers were expected to be kind of half Tom Jones, half Elvis or something. And any bit of rhythm I have is above the waist. There's not much down below. But so I was playing. That was a huge ballroom. We could have anything from 2,500 people every Friday, Saturday and Sunday. And then a smaller version. It was four. That was a mixed band. It was English and Irish musicians. And then during the week, then four of us played the clubs and things like that. Yeah.
When John and Marie had an opportunity to return to Ireland, they decided to uproot themselves and come back to Waterford.
Sandy Jones, if you remember, she was singing with the Dixies after the breakup of all the bands, and she had represented Ireland in Eurovision. She was the only Eurovision singer to sing in Irish. But her husband managed nightclubs, and he got a big offer. He got a big offer to go to Dubai or somewhere like that, Saudi Arabia. And because they were very big into Eurovision, she went with them, and they were looking for a singer. And I think they had heard me at various times, and so that brought us home. The show band industry was just starting to die then in Ireland, but I didn't know in the few years that I'd been away to go down there. But it was okay for a while, and we were doing well, but then we started moving into the north. But I had three bad experiences. First of all, myself and another member of the band were taken out at gunpoint out of a bar one evening when we were setting up with guys with hoods over their heads and guns in our backs. Now, we were lucky. They were IRA guys, and apparently they weren't interested in harming us. Another time in Oma, when we came close to be shot in Oma, I was up against a wall and been searched. And I looked down at the soldier who was on his knees, coming with the gun, and he was younger than I was. His face was puce, and his hands were shaking. I'd say if I had a sneeze, he would have shot me. And that was two. And then the other one, we were coming out of Derry one night, and we had a road manager. He's dead now, God be good to him, a man called Liam White. He was from Drogheda. We were waved down. And we were just pulled in, and Liam shouted back to us, "Lads," he said, "put your heads down, I don't like this." And off he went.
He kept going.
He pulled in and then sped away. And that was it. That was really the last one for me. There was no future in the showbiz at that time.
And during the time touring up in the north, and that you had those two hits. You had a couple of hits.
Yeah,
Goodbye, My Love, Goodbye, and
that was the big one. Goodbye, My Love, Goodbye was a Demis Roussos cover, and that went in. These were days when people genuinely bought records, you know, and it went around. It was in the charts for 3 months. The other one, then She's Leaving, which was, I thought, a better recording, probably, but that it was that never went into the top 10. I think it went as far as 11, but it didn't last that long. Sing a sad old song.
It knows John was happy with his decision to stay in Waterford and leave his career as a professional singer behind.
Marie, my wife, was born and reared in London, in England. And but her parents were Waterford, and she always came back, and she always thought Waterford is home anyway, even though, you know. So less than a month after I parted with the Dixies in great terms, we stayed friends for years after, left and was preparing to go back to London, when again JJ Walsh intervened, and he said to me, "Look, there's a job here for you if you want to stay." And but I said, "Well, no," I said, "I'm more interested in Georgia." But he said, "Look, go back as you were," because they were changing over from hot metal into web offset, and we get that done. And then he said, "Later on, you can move." So I did that for a while. I was still writing kind of reviews, and then eventually I moved over. But about three weeks after I finished with the Dixies, and I just started in the Munster Express, the Miami massacre happened, and poor Tom Dunphy from the Big Eight was killed in a car crash, and Noel Ryan, his keyboard player, was badly injured in it as well.
That must have shaken you to the core, did it?
It did. I knew three of them reasonably well.
But you knew that whole scene, you'd experienced it too. Well, you must have been really frightened.
Well, one of the survivors, Stephen Travers, was a good friend of mine. Stephen was from Carrick. Considered what happened, you know, I can't understand the forgiveness in him, and I don't know, I couldn't be as gracious, you know.
So you're back in the newsroom anyway in the Munster, and you're more involved in the reporting and that.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me what it was like in those days.
We were very busy, and as I said, I knew the business anyway from before, and we saw the best of it. Regional newspapers are having a difficult time, even the national newspapers now, but we had the best of it. But I mean, in those days, WLR didn't exist. Even the Pirates didn't exist when they were after. And, you know, on important weeks, you'd have a queue around the block for the first editions. You know, every time the college went back in September, students looking for flats, the people had, there was a prepaids, people had businesses and had just selling, buy and sell secondhand. It was unbelievable. And of course, politically then, we were very powerful. And
so looking back on it, what did you love about being in the Munster Express? What was it that...
I just loved it. I loved the smell of newsprint, and there was at the end of a run, there's burning oil in the air, there's print in the air, there's ink in the air, and everything like that.
I suppose exhausting. You've all poured your hearts and minds into it.
I tell you what it was. I was reasonably good at what I did, and I could half the time it never was work for me. I'd often go home and. After this work, and I'd be, in those days, we had a typewriter. I had a typewriter at home, and I'd be fiddling around about an article to see what way I could get it to sound better and read better. And it never really bothered me, you know, that. Yeah.
So what sort of a news editor were you in the newsroom? What were you like? Had you a good nose for news?
I had, yeah. I just knew what it'd sell. I knew what people were interested in, yeah.
And what are people interested in, do you think?
Well... truth was, they wanted the facts and they wanted the inside story, but they wanted the truth and they wanted to know, and that's where we built. We never published what I'd call balls of smoke. You never picked up the Munster Express and there was this big, great headline. Wow, was it? And then when you read it, there was little or nothing to it, you know. So
it was solid stories.
Yeah. And I... on an entertainment and a lighter review, I always said there was nothing that would sell apart from the serious part. You know, politics, sex, and ghosts.
They're the three things that would always sell.
Yeah, good one. Yeah, yeah.
And they were in 2017. Then you were honoured a lifetime achievement award in the Hall of Fame by Local Ireland.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
Oh,
yeah,
was it great, John?
Yeah,
in recognition of what you'd accomplished.
Well, sure. I suppose so. It was. I suppose it's nice to be thought of, you know.
For your contribution to the industry and regional newspapers in Ireland and the long-time presenter of the Provincial Newspaper Review on RTE Radio 1 Drive Time.
Yeah, I think that meant a lot. Meant a lot to the other newspapers to be mentioned, and it helped. And originally, for years, I'd have about 8 minutes on a Friday, prime time on a Friday afternoon, coming up to tea time. And I'd always have a serious story. I'd always have something else. You know, you'd have social stories, and then you'd have a quirk and a funny story, you know.
But how did that gig on RTE happen? How did you get that gig?
I was doing bits and pieces. You know, if they needed somebody from a newspaper to talk about a local story, I was doing that. But when I started that, there was three people doing it. The editor of the Connacht Tribune, I think the editor of the Limerick Leader and myself, but they faded away. Now, it wasn't that they weren't good at it, but really what happened was, I suppose I got lucky. Friday afternoons was kind of a free time for them, and they preferred playing golf. And so I ended up doing all that. Yeah.
What news story stands out for you, John, your most memorable now of all the times during the 70s, 80s, 90s?
There was in the early 80s, there was a series of murders in and around Waterford. There was a whole spate of murders. I think there was about three or four murders in quick succession. Now, two of them were connected, but the others weren't. But that was a strange time. A five-year period, I would say, from the time when Waterford Crystal started to, I won't say come asunder, to the time it went. And to some of the Waterford Crystal workers, they held us in high esteem. Others, they didn't. But years after, even the guys who said that they didn't like what we were doing at the time, they said, no, you were right. What we were doing, we were telling them the truth.
And just reporting.
When we broke the news, none of them knew that a lot of Waterford Crystal was then it was being manufactured in Eastern Europe. That was a busy time for the newspaper and with big stories, but it was like a civil war in Waterford, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of bad vibes around at the time.
A hard time, yeah.
And the other one then, that it was an international story and went on for it, was Peter Menton, the Nazi criminal who lived in Leamy Brine in Waterford. And he was exposed, and there was a couple of raids on his house.
So after you retired, you kept on your Tales of the Tellurians, your
yeah.
column.
Yeah.
Has a big readership, John. What do you look for in your column? What do you, every week?
Well, it's very simple. I have the simple thing. I want somebody to pick up the paper and say, I enjoy that. Or perhaps maybe even when they get the paper, oh, I must look at that. Maybe look forward to it. So it's very eclectic. And I do anything and everything, you know.
For me, Lamar, it was lovely to be talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This was made with funding from Commissioner Man and the television license fee.